This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 7th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 350. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and the big deal feature, the MMA panel returns at the midway point of 2024. Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program join me to analyze the second quarter of the year. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Here we are on the 350th edition of the Breaker.News podcast in the middle of 2024, and we're reconvening the MMA panel. I'm Mackin, the first M. The second M is Mario, as in Mario Canseco, the president of Research Co. And the A is Andy, as in Andy Yan, the Duke of Data, the director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University. We're looking at what has gone on in the second quarter of 2024. We're going to look first at Vancouver, where ABC Mayor Ken Sim, he's no longer chairing the police board. Kitsilano Pool is closed for the summer. People in Kits have, I guess they got to go in the water as long as it's not closed at the beach for E. coli. ABC says it wants to look at corporate sponsorship to rebuild the pool. Meanwhile, there is sewage trouble in False Creek near the Olympic Village that blew up literally during the preparation for the Dragon Boat Festival in June. A sign of aging infrastructure. Right. But then another thing that blew up is Mayor Ken Sim and his secret gym. Ken Sim and his secret gym. Pete Fry, the Green Party councillor, showed the world a photo of what's inside there. A former meeting room has turned into a bit of a gym with Peloton and other equipment. And this all seemed to happen around the same time as questions about the mayor's office budgeting. ABC in 2022 promised to spend less on the office of the mayor than Kennedy Stewart, who had two chiefs of staff, and it also promised to be less political. Well, it's easier said than done. Andy Yan, what do you think of these broken promises and this extra money being spent by the mayor's office for the supermajority ABC party?
Well, I think it's not a good look. I think that Pete Fry, I think, described this gym as the Mojo Dojo. And I think that it's, I think, really talking about really what's the perception of this particular council and this particular mayor in terms of how they're governing. And I think that, you know, what some folks have kind of described this as the vibes council and the kind of vibes that they're projecting, or the how they read vibes in how the city is operating, I think is something that I think is going forward, I think, going to be an interesting issue. I mean, the fact that it jumps, that the mayor's office budget jumps from basically $1 million to $1.5 million in about 5 years, I think really highlights, I think, some ongoing questions around governance and around the kind of local government that is occurring in terms of the accounting of how those dollars are being spent, where those dollars are being spent. And yet at the same time, I think having a gym at City Hall at the mayor's gym really actually misses the fact that there are already gyms for city staff that are actually in the basement of City Hall, for which kind of asks about really what's the best use of facilities. That similarly, this conference room was apparently used before as a preparation for speakers, and at times speakers on some very difficult issues, to kind of prepare and to gather their thoughts before they present to council, through which now is converted into a private gym, which isn't necessarily the best look in the world.
Mario Canseco, do you think that this is the tip of the iceberg, that there'll be more reps for Ken Sim and his staff as we get closer, for instance, to the World Cup in 2026, that they will have a temptation to add even more staff? Do you think that that's going to happen? And do you think that they'll be allowed to do it?
I think it'll depend on the way that people react to this. I always believed that the show Spin City with Michael J. Fox and then later on Charlie Sheen was a comedy, but it's making what is happening in Vancouver pretty similar in comparison. It's not the type of situation that you want to have. I think the way in which the media has covered this, it's appealing to our sense of dismay, but it's not expressing the dismay in the way we would have in previous years. And I think that is part of the essence of the argument. It's not a situation where you're going against what the mayor tries to do or when you compare it with other situations. The fact that there's been so much reliance on the notion that everything that is expensive and difficult to do is going to have a sponsor could very well have us bringing our families or our friends from outside of the city into Wreck Beach brought to you by OnlyFans. It's definitely a possibility. And it's not the kind of city that was promised. It's not the type of situation that was supposed to happen. And it really depends on how the opposition can assemble itself before the next election, whether those center-right voters who looked at ABC as a vehicle for change are satisfied with the way things are going, particularly because of the kids' pool, and whether the left can get its act together and say, we'll have a unity candidate, we'll have a designated number of people running for council in all of the other bodies. And that's the way in which we'll turn this into the way elections used to be in the 90s, a left option and a right option. But right now, it's very difficult to know whether that'll happen.
We're going to move to Surrey next. Fans of Mayor Brenda Locke and her stance against the RCMP, however, her court challenge failed. The cop swap that won't stop will stop, the NDP has decreed. November is when the transition happens. No surprise that Brenda Locke and the City of Surrey's court challenge failed, because local government is a creature of the provincial government. And the provincial government wants to get rid of the RCMP, replace it with a Surrey Police Service, even with the extra cost to Surrey taxpayers, which could have an impact in the election in October. Mario, did Brenda Locke win the court of public opinion? She lost the court of law, but did she win in the court of public opinion?
Now, I think it'll depend on the way in which the campaign unfolds. It's not right now a significant issue. If we had the same type of violence, street violence that we had, or the shootings that we had prior to the 2008 election or the 2011 election, when you couldn't look anywhere and not see a story about Surrey in that fashion, that would be more dangerous for them. It's not the same type of situation. We don't see crime and public safety climbing the charts as an issue at the BC-wide level. But I think it's really about the opportunity to establish an emotional connection. And I think she tried to do that, but it's tough to do that when you're a municipal politician with a mandate based on a very low turnout compared to somebody who's actually running the government of the entire province from Victoria. I think that is part of the imbalance when it comes to somebody saying, I'm here for my city, and somebody saying, I'm here for the entire province. Now, that being said, there's a chance for the opposition to try to connect on this, but not necessarily by hitching their wagon to whatever the mayor wants to do, but ultimately on figuring out a way to criticize what is happening and to ask the people in Surrey to look for a better option. We've seen the Conservatives climbing the charts in some places. They're doing very well in the north, very well in the Fraser Valley. If they can connect in Surrey, it's not something that might suggest that the election is not going to be won by the NDP. But it certainly wouldn't be nice to, have your final seat count and go, well, I lost some of the seats that I won in 2020, because the way we treated Surrey wasn't fair.
I think that she stood up for her city. So that to that extent, I think she perhaps does have a certain victory here in saying that I fought the good fight. I fought for what I thought was good for the city of Surrey. I didn't win, but I still at least represented what I thought was the right thing for my city. So I think that to that extent, I think it provided a level of victory. But yet, at the same time, I think that there are going to be some pretty big questions in terms of the future cost of the Surrey police force, really how much the final bill will occur, like once you kind of lay out all from all the court challenges to the actual operations of a police force, just knowing the experience of, say, the city of Vancouver and how expensive it does cost to operate a municipal police force, and how that may be, I mean, mind you, this is going to be well after this current election, how that is going to be said and put on the province in terms of the imposition of this force by the province. That's going to be the thing to watch. But I think just overall, I think it's important to understand that the Surrey ridings could be the battlefield ridings, that they could be the ones that, you know, certainly I don't think the NDP are going to lose this provincial election. But yet at the same time, I think it's the question of what kind of margins are they looking at. I think that if anything, I think the kind of changes demographically and how those ridings are changing as we speak, I think, is really putting up for a really interesting races in terms of who's going to win in these particular ridings in Surrey, as I think that those ridings are up for grabs as opposed to other ridings, say, in the city of Vancouver.
Now, moving to Metro Vancouver, the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant's $3 billion cost overrun and Commissioner Jerry Dabovolny's 711,000 pay packet for 2023. Over at TransLink, their highest paid executive is the CEO, Kevin Quinn. He was paid more than $500,000 last year. Now, they have problems. The sewage plant is delayed to 2030, and the Broadway subway, which TransLink was hoping to use next year, it's delayed to 2027. How do we fix Metro Vancouver and its governance? And should we fix TransLink at the same time?
Oh, that's one of the big, interesting, ongoing questions that every political science student in regional governance faces, that, you know, how much of it should be an elected board, how much of it should be the mayors, where does regional governance fit into how we govern our communities. I think that a lot of this is also covering, if you will, these initial costs in terms of the overage of the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant. This is just the opening trailer of the rather very profound infrastructure challenges we face ahead of us. That a lot of this represents not only, say, a deficit in terms of the investment in our infrastructure, particularly wastewater or water to begin with, but you have to remember there was a story in the Vancouver Sun talking about how 19% of the various pipes in the water system of Metropolitan Vancouver are in poor condition that will need a level of replacement that really touches upon the kind of deficits we're facing in terms of our infrastructure, just as we're planning to have all this growth. And I think that this is going to be one of the big questions as we have this aspiration in terms of legislation, in terms of additional housing and new housing via private development. Who's going to pay for it? What's the fairest distribution between new residents and old residences, and much less the kind of profits that are made on these new developments, and how much of those profits ought to go into supporting this new infrastructure. So I think that this is, if you will, just the opening salvos of really, I think, an op a larger challenge in terms of how we pay to live in this region.
American Seiko, should there be direct elections for Metro Vancouver directors? And should we do the same time, the same thing for TransLink directors?
I think voting is part of the problem when you have councillors who are elected with a turnout that is dismally low, and they're making decisions that are going to have implications on budgets that they can't even fathom. You can't have a person coming in from a 25,000 inhabitant municipality raising their hand or lowering it to vote on something that is going to cost billions of dollars. Now, a few months ago, we talked about the experience of Jerry having to go out there and say, you know, this is out of budget, sorry. You know, that kind of job costs money. And again, you know, we're having all of these discussions. Where is the discussion about the people who authorized this type of salary and this type of expenditure for a public servant? You know, it's part of the complexity of having people who perhaps are not that well versed in budgeting or in planning, but who happen to make it to council on a wide range of reasons, and who are suddenly deciding that they are the ones who are going to be calling the shots. Like it's amalgamation seems like something that is far into the future. You know, it might happen perhaps with the two North Vancouvers or the two Langleys at some point. But I don't see us necessarily moving into a system like the one they have in Montreal or in Toronto. But unless we continue to motivate the electorate and make sure that they know that their decisions on municipal elections have far-reaching consequences, we're talking about billions of dollars, then we're never going to get this solved because the system is the one that enables poorly educated councillors to make decisions about amounts of money that they can't even imagine.
Now we're going provincial. Here we are, British Columbia, 15 weeks to go until provincial election day in October. The story in the second quarter has been the rise of the BC Conservatives and the decline of BC United. John Rastad up and Kevin Falcon down. Merger talks failed, but now there is a migration of candidates, a migration of money. The Conservatives say that they raised more than $1 million in the second quarter. The caucus doubled. Eleanor Sturco and Lauren Dirksen left BC United to join the Conservatives. Now, the Conservatives are for real, but can they pull off a win? And conversely, the NDP, which says it raised $2.2 million in quarter two, could they lose? What are we looking at in the next 15 weeks as we get closer to election day? Mario.
Well, we knew this was going to happen. We knew there was going to be a moment when suddenly the money that was going to BC United was not going to go to BC United. We talked about this a few months ago, and I think this is part of what is happening. You know, if you're somebody who's not happy with the NDP government, you're looking for that vehicle, whether you're a voter, whether you're a donor, regardless of your position or how much you can donate or give to the cause, you're looking for that vehicle. And it's clear that that vehicle is the BC Conservatives now. Now, this is also crucial in the sense that the rise of the conservatives has been happening partly because of the middle-aged voters who are disenchanted with the way things are going, and 18 to 34-year-olds who maybe are not necessarily conservative from a mental and ideological standpoint, but are looking at an option that might make things easier for the challenges that they're facing. Elections are won basically with the over 55 vote. It's solidly in the hands of the NDP. I think that is going to be crucial to watch. What happens with that over 55 vote? If you start to see the Conservatives winning that vote, then it's a significantly more complicated endeavor for their chances. But in a way, this is what the establishment party used to look like. You know, we had elections in 2009, for instance, where the young people were going at the NDP, and the over 55 vote was clearly with Gordon Campbell. So it's deliciously ironic in a way that the NDP has become the establishment party for the over 55s and for the business industry. You don't get to raise $2.2 million without the industry saying, things are okay. I don't think I'm going to hand the keys to the rein to Rostad or, God forbid, Falcon.
And Anne, what do you think?
Well, I think that it's really covering, I think, the possibility of, is this the moment through which we see that demographic handover, that this is really that moment through which we see the kind of baby boomers now really start beginning to diminish, and then the rise of the millennials, those in their 30s, that the largest population group is are now people, those in their mid-30s, not in their young 20s anymore. They're actually now in their 30s. And I think that how that changes, particularly on issues that they care about the most. And you got to remember, in your early 30s is really when you're starting to settle down. You want to purchase your first residence. You want to start having kids. That it all rolls together, I think, to some pretty interesting, I think, political times. Simply because if you look at, say, what's happening in other countries, how those younger populations, which you could count on definitely voting, say, to the left, or certainly to the center, you know, now are parts of it are fracturing away, getting frustrated at really the state of housing, the state of the economy, the state of the cost of living, that begins this kind of curiosity with those who are, say, on the right, that those are in the that really you didn't necessarily think would appeal to those who are younger writer, younger voters of younger prior times. And I think this is something to watch because it's certainly happening in, say, the federal and the federal level. I think it's interesting to see the amount of young voters actually vote, be very curious about the conservatives, and whether this is happening on the provincial level. I think it kind of really perhaps talks to these larger trends in the world where you do see the rise of the right in terms of, say, more market forces going into the role of individuals and what they do in the economy. That I think that this is really going to be the interesting thing to see. And will this lead to a conservative victory in the provincial election? I don't think so, but yet at the same time, it does potentially, I think, shake things up in terms of what's happening in British Columbian politics.
But we're going to finish off with the national scene. The second quarter, Justin Trudeau's popularity continued to nosedive. That was the big story. We did see the Foreign Interference Inquiry issue its first report. Madam Justice Hogue said that there was foreign interference in 2019-2021 elections, but it didn't make a difference. However, there was that report to Parliament, the NCCOP report, that said that there are MPs colluding with foreign adversaries, raising the question of treason. Same time, there were charges in the investigation of the murder of Hardeep Singh Najjar, the Surrey Khalistani Sikh independence leader, raising more questions about the rift between Canada and India. However, Justin Trudeau, during the quarter, issued his Fairness for Every Generation, his housing plan. He wants to build 4 million homes by 2031, quite a glossy campaign, but it didn't seem to move the needle. The question here is, with people starting to openly suggest that Justin Trudeau should resign and let someone else take over the party, the big question here is, during the summer, this is your prediction, should Justin Trudeau take a walk in the sand like his father famously took a walk in the snow and decide to resign?
I don't think it'll happen this summer. I think he'll try to stay a little bit longer, maybe wait, see if the numbers start to get a little bit better for them at the end of the year. It's not a good situation for them, of course. And again, I see some parallelisms with what happened with Gregor Robertson. You know, you get elected on the votes of young, urban, cycling, very healthy-minded people who look at you and think that you're going to deliver them to the promised land. And then that same voter 10 years later has a car, needs a place to park it, needs a place for his kid who's now in daycare and can't find it. And that is how governments fall apart. I think what we're seeing is that the group that voted very heavily for the Liberals becoming quite disenchanted with the fact that they didn't see this coming. The housing issue is not new for us. You know, we've been looking at it as something that is a concern for British Columbians for years. But now you're seeing places where the Liberals really need the votes. The GTA, Atlantic Canada, right. Those are the places that right now are going, well, I can't afford anything, and this is going to be way too complicated. So there's got to be a way to reconnect. I still think out of everything that I see in the party right now, he's the best vehicle to try to mount a comeback. I don't think there's anybody else who is ready to take on the role that he has in front of him. And I'd be surprised if in the next few weeks they decide that they're going to do better without him.
Andy Yan, on this question, does Justin Trudeau come to Tofino? Does he take a walk in the sand? Or does he just jump over the sand and go surfing and just keep on surfing?
Just keep on heading into, you do the whole Point Break thing. You know, Rhodey just goes right into the wave. He just one last ride. And, you know, that's an interesting question. But then, of course, you know, how much of that wave was really an exemplified what happened in Toronto, St. Paul, that kind of, you know, what used to be just a wall of red now has a faint blue speck in it, and how much of that is a point into the potential future. But of course, I'm always curious, because certainly some of the kind of observations I've heard is actually part of this is also connected with what could perhaps happen south of the border. Really, what will happen, what could quite possibly be a second Trump presidency, and how that might shape how Canadians might vote or not. that I think is the thing to watch in terms of what's happening. But yeah, touching upon what Mario had talked about, I mean, you think about what's happening in France, you know, with Emmanuel Macron, a similar, you know, good-looking, kind of energetic leader who, you know, thought was going to deliver France to the promised land, and yet through his government's fail. And in terms of making people feel like the future includes them, that I think this is the similar kind of challenge that Justin Trudeau is facing, is that I think fundamentally it's like coming in on this kind of mandate of change, and yet people not necessarily seeing this change, feeling that things have actually meant going backwards, that they don't necessarily see hope, they see despair. And I think as such, really the question will be, is Pierre Poilievre the one to deliver them from despair to hope? I think that's going to be the thing to watch. But yet I think a lot of this is, there's still a lot of balls in the air. But yet I think, you know, will Justin Trudeau take that one last wave out, I think is going to be the kind of key question moving into the fall.
Mario Canseco and Andy Yan, the other M and the only A of the MMA panel. Thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, China can now carry out spot inspections of smartphones. Sealing or a seizure of the devices may be carried out, state security officer. Regulations allowing authorities to conduct spot inspections of smartphones went into effect in China on July 1st, leading to concerns among travelers about arbitrary searches of their mobile devices. The guidelines are based on China's counter-espionage law and criminal procedure law and allow for the inspection of smartphones and other electronic devices. In Kyoto news, Costco proving a one-stop shop for regional revitalization in Japan. Costco currently has a total of 33 stores in 21 of Japan's 47 prefectures, with new stores planned in 2024 in three more locations: Higashiyomi, Ogori, and Nanjo. Costco Wholesale Japan Limited has clear-cut conditions for opening an outlet, a population of more than 500,000 within a radius of 10 kilometers, and area for a parking lot that can accommodate more than 800 cars. In Hong Kong Free Press, elderly busker jailed after playing protest anthem Glory to Hong Kong faces fresh charges. Lee Ji-chin, 70, was sentenced to 30 days in prison last October for an unlicensed performance and fundraising after playing the protest anthem Glory to Hong Kong in public, with Magistrate Amy Chan saying that his offenses amounted to, quote, soft resistance, end quote. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In Willamette Week, Oregon Environmental Regulators DEI Council publishes pro-Palestine statement. The message was posted on an internal agency webpage for 4 days before being taken down. Department of Environmental Quality leaders disavowed the message. Quote, Director Felden and the DEI Council had a discussion about why this message was not appropriate to send out over state systems prior to the message being posted. Lauren Wirtis, a spokeswoman for DEQ, wrote in an emailed statement, quote, DEQ recognizes worldwide events can impact staff and continually encourages staff to access the resources available to support them if needed, end quote. In Crosscut, Washington Supreme Court upholds Lacey law limiting homeless RV parking. Judges unanimously dismissed a challenge to a Lacey law targeting homeless people living in recreational vehicles. The decision comes days after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that cities may ban homeless people from sleeping outdoors even if they do not first offer shelter. Cities have already begun proposing stricter anti-camping laws in the days since the Supreme Court ruling. And last week in the Breaker.News, TransLink's 2023 pay parade shows CEO over the $500,000 mark, and embattled lawyer Hong Guo loses another court battle. Read those stories and more on the Breaker.News. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week posthumously to the late Ken Denike, University of British Columbia geography professor whose studies focused on transportation and education. He passed away May 31st at age 84. Ken Denike had a hand in Vancouver's Expo Line SkyTrain, the creation of regional health boards, and later, as a municipal politician, he chaired the Vancouver School Board. My condolences to Ken's family, including his wife, Sophia Wu. A memorial is being planned for September. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 7th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 7th of July in 1534, that's 490 years ago, French explorer Jacques Cartier made contact with Mi'kmaq people at Chaleur Bay on the Gaspé Peninsula? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News on X, formerly Twitter, for news as it happens. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.